everyone, and welcome to the EG Retail and Leisure Talk. My name is Sam McClary. I'm the Deputy Editor and Head of Content at EG. Very shortly, I'll introduce you to my colleague, James Child, who will give you a presentation on where occupiers are moving. And then I will introduce you again to our panel we have here. Mark Sherwood, who's Director of Attis Asset Management. That's hard to say. John Mew, Chief Operating Officer of ABP London. Stuart Harris, Commercial Director and Co-Founder of Queensbury Real Estate. And Emma McKenzie, Director at New River. But for now, let me hand over to James.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you, Sam. Can you all hear me? Yep. Good, good. Okay, so my name is James Child. I'm Retail and Industrial Analyst at EG. And this afternoon, just to introduce the session, I'm going to be looking at where occupiers are moving and why. So looking at some of the data behind what's driving retailers to move to new and different locations, and what this means for landlords and developers in terms of retention of old retail space and indeed new retail space as well. So, first up, I'll take a look at some of the latest news and content that we've been covering at EG. Then I'll have a look at some of the stats, so looking at retail take-up year on year, as well as some of the occupier sectors as well. Then I'll look at some of the why and some of the trends that have been emerging over the past few years in terms of the creation of new places and spaces, and then some short conclusions towards the end. So quite a lot to get through in the next 10 minutes or so, but I will try my best. So back in all the way back in January, we actually reported that a diverse F&B offer is actually ranked as the most important aspect of a retail experience for younger people or for millennials. Now that has of course had a knock-on effect in terms of regeneration and refurbishment programs up and down the country in major schemes, and we all know that the F&B to retail ratio is much greater than it's ever been before. So consumers clearly driving that. And indeed, it's really shaped the new shape of retail and leisure. And we know that consumers are now clearly dictating what it means to have a successful retail destination. So moving on then, let's have a look at some of the market indicators so far this year. Retail take-up has dropped 11% year-on-year in overall square footage terms. And that's actually symptomatic of the rest of commercial real estate at the moment. We see that London offices has dropped by around 12% as well, and those key city offices in the region's down 13%. And even the industrial sector, which we all know has been largely resilient over the past few years, has dropped off by around 7% as well. So not just retail that's perhaps felt the pinch post-Brexit. Moving on then, a quick look at those retail occupier sectors I mentioned. And the first thing you'll notice is over on the left-hand side, F&B. What you can hopefully see is the blue there is 2016 and the orange 2017 as deal share. Now we know that food and beverage has jumped up from 25% to 27% year on year, helped by the expansion activity of several national chains. Some of those you can actually see on the screen now. They've actually been making the move from those traditional heartlands in central areas to retail parks and out of town locations as well. Now, the rise of F&B has been well documented, but the questions have been raised about whether we're actually reaching a natural saturation point in that sector and if that bubble is actually going to burst. And this report by Cushman & Wakefield, which was published earlier on this year, is probably the best reading around the subject if you're interested, looking at how sustainable growth in this sector actually is, especially considering the economic circumstances that consumers currently face themselves with. And indeed, when we reflect on our own data, we do see a gradual slowdown of the F&B deal share. 2018 will probably be the litmus test here. If we see perhaps a levelling out on that graph or even perhaps a dip or ebbing away. Back to the sectors then, health and beauty's had a really good year as well. So that's increased its deal share from 13% to 15%. Interestingly, in this sector, online spend only accounts for 4.5%. Now the national average comes in at around 14-15% at the moment, so perhaps health and beauty is more resilient from that online threat than perhaps other sectors, which is encouraging for the physical side of retail. Of course, some of the sectors haven't fared too well. Fashion after successive years of really strong take-ups, actually seen a downfall. It's actually had its worst sales for a July period since 2009. Down 3.5% as consumers seemingly turn their attention to essential goods post-Brexit. And it's a fairly similar story with value as well. So that intense value brand expansion we've seen for the past 3, 4, 5 years has really slowed down. And we actually have administrations hindering growth as well with the 99p store portfolio and Poundland too. So that's a bit about what's happening with those sectors. Let's have a look at where they're actually going to. So retail deal share by location. I'm going to introduce those traditional locations, if you like, high street retail park and shopping centres. You can see the high street line up on around 50% for that 5-year period. Retail parks coming in there and shopping centres. Now, at a first glance, nothing too dramatic with those lines. They kind of remain fairly parallel with each other along that graph until the end part in the last 3 years. We do begin to see some patterns emerging. The high streets dropped from 56 to 50%, and retail parks have actually jumped up from 15 to 19%. And this is really indicative of something that we've noticed at EG, with a real trend from retailers moving from those high street central locations to those out-of-town areas. And I'm just going to touch on a couple of areas where we have seen direct evidence for that as well. So starting with the high street. Now, these are some of the brands that you'll definitely recognise. They've gone into administration over the past 18 months or so. We looked at the data at EG, and we found that that entire portfolio footprint comes in at around 8.5 million square foot space. And of that space, only 43% of it has actually been relet. 85% of that space is located on the high street. So that gives you an idea of how much vacant space from those administrations we're actually looking at. So lots of space that's, you know, should be recycled, but at the same time, we're seeing a real proliferation for brand new planning applications for new space. This chart indicates brand new schemes, so anything we define as over 50,000 square foot. And the first thing you'll notice is that blue line has really been trending upwards since 2010, and the orange line's been coming downwards since 2011. The headline there, you can see the blue line's up 60% year on year, and it's at a 10-year high. So I appreciate there's quite a lot of data and quite a lot of numbers, but once we start stitching those together, we do begin to see a real story emerging. There has undeniably been a swing towards out-of-town locations. We've just seen with take-up increasing from 15 to 19%. We've also seen those applications up to 60%. And that despite, of course, those attempts to future-proof those central locations by the MPPF and the Town Centre First policy, which I believe was all the way back in March 2012. So at first glance, it doesn't really look like it's helped, and perhaps even it's gone the other way. Now, who's actually been driving that change in locations? Well, we know the consumers are still happy to travel to those out-of-town destinations, as for them, convenience remains key. And as we've already seen, retailers follow consumers. Retailers are willing to downsize their central portfolios in order to acquire bigger stores for cheaper rent. So it works both ways as well. But in terms of this session and what it means for perhaps developers and landlords, in order to secure central locations specifically, do we perhaps need to bring people back into those central locations? We have seen a couple of examples of this over the past few months. Sorry. So back in April, we actually done a study on London shopping centres, and we found that one third of them have got plans for redevelopment, and all of those plans incorporate residential into that as well. So clearly, a move to bring people back into those areas, into those central boroughs, and create polycentric communities, if you like. But of course, it's not just London, it's happening in Manchester as well. And we've seen that the Manchester nightlife has really been fueled by a return to city centre living. So moving away from the 9-to-5 and really trying to incorporate a real retail and leisure and life experience for people that live in those areas. And obviously the phrase live, work and play springs to mind as well. So perhaps some food for thought there for developers and landlords and the panel. That's all from me, a bit of a whirlwind tour around data, but hopefully some food for thought for the panel and perhaps some questions for yourself. If you do have any questions, do come and find me afterwards. But I'm due to hand back to Sam. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, James. Now, I know we are running a little bit behind time, and I know Mark does have to leave on time. So we will try and get through as much as possible. Mark, if you do have to get up and run out, please do. And thank you, James, for that. So yesterday, hopefully you will have seen on EG that we revealed that the Crown Estate and TH Real Estate had canned their plans, first submitted in 2015, to build a £75 million, 180,000 square foot extension to Princess Shay, that's hard to say as well, shopping centre in Exeter. And they cited current market conditions for that reason, and were brave enough and frank enough to say that retailers and restaurateurs were just too cautious to commit for them to be able to go ahead and build that extension. Which brings us to today's panel discussion. If you build it, will they come? Or perhaps the question indeed should be, should you really build it? And in Exeter's case, perhaps the answer there was no. So in my demanding way, as anyone who's ever had the displeasure of working or riding a bike with me, I asked James to pull me together a quick few stats on planned retail extensions. Because it was quick, there might be a few omissions here, but just to get the conversation flowing, a few key stats. So there's around about 7 million square foot of new retail extensions planned between 2018 and 2020-ish. The majority of those are planned for the southeast, 1.7 million square foot, followed by London, just under 1.5, and the same amount in Scotland, and then the West Midlands with a 500,000 square foot. More than a quarter of that is for out of town. So that's a lot of new space and does not include new developments, does not include that 8.5 million square foot of administrative space that James mentioned there. So, you know, do we need to build extra space? And if we do build it, will the tenants come? So that's what we'll be discussing today. And Stuart, I wanted to start with you, actually, because you're obviously developing 500,000 square foot in Barnsley. You've got 40k in Bradford. You've obviously got a 7-hectare site up in Sheffield that you've got big plans for. How do you feel about that question? Should we build it? And if we build it, how do we get them to come?
I think the very simple answer to it is no. Without looking at the individual merits of each town and city, looking at its current supply, I think in terms of most of the locations that we're looking at, everybody's about the experience they get from social engagement. When we talk about the internet and what you do get on the internet, but what you don't get is that social interaction. We all crave it as human beings. How do we make our town centres, how do we make our shopping centres more vibrant so they want to attract more people? A lot of the developments that we're now involved in, we're collaborating with local authorities. And it's not just about the retail anymore. Yes, we've got retail and F&B, and we've got other leisure uses, but we're seeing more civic uses come back into play. We're seeing more residential, we're seeing more offices. I think it was a trend about 10 or 15 years ago for offices to go out of town. Most of the office occupiers out of town found that their staff were bored being out of town. They're now coming back in, which obviously has a positive impact on the retailers and the F&B. And I think the local authorities are the ones that, in some cases, are best placed, certainly outside of London, where the biggest problem we have is making these developments actually stack up and be feasible.
And Emma, we were talking just before this about New River isn't just a retail company anymore, because you've already responded to that need to change what shopping centres are out of town, parks are, and you're doing a lot of resi with all of the new developments that you're doing.
Yeah, we're doing much more mixed-use sort of development, and we've got about 1.9 million square feet in the development pipeline throughout the portfolio. And a lot of that is mixed use. We've got hotels, cinemas, F&B, and some residential, because ultimately a lot of the residential is going on you know, zero site value, and that actually adds value to the overall development project. And again, it feeds the retail, and it brings residential back into the town centres. And certainly, I mean, our whole model is community focused and convenience led, and that mixed use works very well with retail.
And Mark, from an occupier perspective, you obviously have that background and are now in the asset management world. How are we having to react to what occupiers want and need?
I think the story has to be incredibly compelling. Yeah. There's a lot of nervousness out there, there's a lot of uncertainty, and I think that retail as a whole is going through quite an evolutionary phase. You know, you said in your earlier comments that it's reacting a lot to the tech world, and I don't think the bricks and mortar retailers have really found a convincing way forward. They will find it and it will come through because everyone's going to keep trying, but right now that element of the unknown and that caution means that if they are going to locate into any new development, it has to be a very strong story.
Can any of you hear each other?
It's quite difficult.
It's a real struggle.
Can I get some headphones, please?
Yeah, you can.
Thank you.
That's better. You can hear what each other's saying now. I don't know if that is better or not, but...
can't hear.
John, chip in there with... Oh, uh-oh.
It's
okay,
all
no
right.
Headphones.
You've got a light now. I can't hear. But carry on, please.
Okay. Yeah. John, you're obviously developing a whole lot of space down at the Royal Docks, not just retail. You've got a whole new community down there. Are you at all concerned about the amount of space that you're developing and the current climate?
Not at all. I mean, what we are doing is actually on a lesser scale compared to what we do in China. Now, I think all the panelists already spoke, and one thing is you can't actually expect retail will come on its own when you build it. You need to do it through detailed master planning, through critical mass developments in order to create that community. We are not talking about shopping center high street anymore. We view it as recreating a community shop. We create a community within our developments that will internally create a demand as well as we insert the USP into that special area. What we're doing and create again the footfall from the outside of that community. So you can't actually just do it on its own and expect organic growth to come out. You've got to create something different and with commitment, with critical mass, and with a detailed master planning. But through that, we don't see that it's a problem for us.
And how do you know then exactly what it is that you should be developing when a consumer base is changing so quickly? What, you know, are you using data, are you using different forms of statistics to know what people are doing?
Sure, of course, statistics is heavily relying on, and so that we can actually see the trend. For example, where we are in East London Road Dock, we can see is population get in there is getting younger. I mean, one of your slides says like young population, well, London is getting younger, and therefore the spending power, the consumer, they're getting younger as well. I see shops in central London, those shops sell to young customers. They always have queue of people, nothing really special, but their customer audience, their target customer is young customer. And with statistics, we already show in East London, it's one of the youngest towns, fast growing as well, where the tenant, newly educated, and all the new immigrant, professional immigrant that come to London, they're all focused in East London. There's many reasons for that. One is cost of living is still comparable, cheaper compared to rest of town, especially west of the town. And therefore we can see on that part of the area is actually getting younger and more vibrant, and the people living there are professional. And for that, that's why we're heavily investing into that area, because we can see that is actually the future of London.
I think where it's different is when you are developing more regionally.
Yes.
Because you are trying to create a new town centre in a lot of these cases. So I think in John's situation, a lot of things, the demographic is more defined. I think when you look at regional, the tendency has been to, in the past, fill shopping centres with the younger operators and alienate some of the older shoppers as well, who maybe aren't as internet savvy as well, so they're almost an open book to bring in. So I think demographic information is a very important part of assessing what's right. Mm. But I think also what you see and hear with your own eyes and ears is really important as well, because research and data might tell you that it has a certain supply, but actually when you go there, you understand it's a very poor supply, or it's in the wrong place or the wrong location. And certainly with a lot of towns that we're working in, what they're really, really focused on is bringing about that evening economy and bringing families back in the evening. So it's a slightly different challenge out of London than it is in London.
Yeah. I think it's a different market.
And certainly from our perspective, we use a lot of data to inform our decisions. Footfall data, for example, just on specific shopping centres, but also a lot of demographic information. And certainly the research that we've done actually says the millennials don't have any money, and where the money is the grey pound. So 46% of our shoppers are over 55 years of age, and they're in our centres once and twice a week, and they're regularly shopping locally. And that's certainly where we're focusing going forward, is that spend is certainly very bricks and mortar led, not as online as a younger shopper is. And that the growth in bricks and mortar sales is set to grow by 10% in the next 5 years. So that's where we are using the information of data and demographics to inform what we are doing, and making sure that that over 55 market is catered for. And certainly from consumer surveys, we're also finding that that market are also the ones that are looking after grandchildren and children. So they're again in the shops more regularly than perhaps that younger parent actually is.
And you'd think that this might be my own unconscious bias coming in, but that grey pound, the over 55s, is the market that you'd expect to shop maybe in the department stores, but we're not seeing that reflected in department store sales. And Mark, you obviously have quite a background there as well, and a current job and consulting on one of the big department store chains. Are they still a legitimate anchor, do you think, for shopping centres or town centres, and maybe Emma and Stuart have a different opinion, but I'd be interested to hear yours.
Well, are department stores a legitimate anchor?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that department stores are going through a period that's particularly challenging, but they're all looking to reinvent themselves, and there's very few places that can match a department store for the range of brands that they can bring in and market. And those brands can't be there in the high street unless they invest very significantly in that individual retail unit offer. And so that range and convenience that the department stores offer, it is still a very significant draw. And certainly to the age demographic that you're talking about, they really still love the department stores, and they're very loyal to them.
Stuart, Emma, do you see that?
I think there are some real challenges in department store market with the historic portfolios the department stores got, and I think they recognise that. There are a lot of portfolios, quite a large percentage of it is not fit for purpose. I think if they're done right, absolutely. I'd say a very good example recently, and I'd encourage anybody to go and have a look, is the Fenix in Bracknell. I think they've done a fantastic job. I think from a landlord perspective, the concern with department stores at the moment is there's been a tendency, a trend, to incorporate more F&B. And actually that's taking away from the overall offer that you've got in the shopping centre. You've brought in a department store to give you an offer, and for a reason. And if that department store then starts bringing in other retailers and other F&B operators, it has a direct impact on the financial viability of what you're doing. So I think there's some big challenges in that market. You don't always need them. In Barnsley, we haven't got an anchor store because we've designed the scheme so that it loops off the main high street. But I think where you're creating something where it's more of a destination, definitely, because the other retailers will still follow.
Yeah. I mean, similarly, what was BHS in our shopping centre in Bexley Heath, and for a long time, BHS hadn't been adding anything in terms of retail offer, and Morley's have gone into that as a department store, and it's fit for purpose in the sense that it's the perfect size. A lot of the department stores historically have now got too much space, whereas if the space is needed and retail properly merchandised, it still is a very attractive offer. And again, definitely the demographics of Bexley Heath and our traditional shopper being that grey pound, it's been very, very well received, and certainly has added an awful lot more than the BHS was to
the scheme.
And do you think we need to diversify even more with the types of occupiers that we are having in retail schemes or out of town or town centres? So we've have an interview this week with Raymond Petzman, if I've said that right, who's ex-Amazon property director, and he says, or he reckons that all malls will need a logistics service or logistics centre in them. So should we, you know, if we are going to make retail survive and if we are going to build it, do we need to think about, okay, well, delivery centres, pickup centres, drone parks? I don't know. Do we need to go down that route?
I think it's a trend. It's a market thing. It happens to, yeah, it's its anchor. But I think the trend is move on to online, offline. Now, I understand why Amundsen say what he say, but at the end of the day, I think it's the online, offline. It's an experience for the all generation. It's not just older, younger, but it's you can actually have the choices at the ease, but also have the price on the online. But however, you still have the service in the shopping mall or in the high street or in any shopping area that allow retailer to promote their things much more wider audience as compared to just a shop. And it has been taken very rapidly, this idea online, offline in Far East, Hong Kong and China. But I think this is in the UK, it's a bigger market. I can see the trend. There's room for more online, offline service or online, offline type of retailing.
I think a lot of the retailers find the whole online offer very difficult to manage. And I think they've got a lot of stock that's actually out hanging in people's bedrooms, which actually there's two dresses of two different colours and three different sizes hanging in someone's bedroom, and they send five back and keep one. And by the time it gets back, it's all reduced, and two or three people could have bought those dresses and haven't. And most of the retailers, particularly the fashion retailers, say exactly that. It's a very difficult thing to make money at. And now they're kind of stuck with it, and they've been almost a victim of their own success with it. And certainly from our perspective, click and collect is a great driver of footfall into the shopping centres, and we find that the click and collect shopper spends more than maybe the average customer, and that they also then partake of food and beverage, and 46% of those that partake of that food and beverage then go on to spend more money in the schemes. So click and collect from our perspective is a positive thing, and we certainly try and encourage it and work with either the retailers or the look at Amazon lockers, etc., in the schemes, which have been very successful.
Should we get James tracking click and collect stores in shopping centres? Yes. Yeah.
I was going to say that I think one of the best examples of a very successful click and collect offer was actually Waitrose, and they went into the smaller towns because they found people were going to pick up their click and collect. And we all know what it's like when we go shopping, especially when we're, or food shopping when we're hungry. People couldn't help themselves, so their sales were exponential in terms of growth. And I think you're seeing that through click and collect offers in centres. I think whilst people arrive, and I think the car parking has to link into this, you have to enable. So it's about enable people to shop how they want, how people to gather goods how they want. But people going to pick up click and collect were probably staying for about an average of about an hour afterwards to shop. So that's a good dwell time post literally going to just pick up something they've ordered online.
And I think a lot of offices now are also starting to say no thanks to personal deliveries being happening in the office environment, because they're ending up with all sorts of stuff piling up in reception. So as more and more people are refusing, are not having allowed to accept personal packages at work, it's going to be where they can pick it up most conveniently and probably nearest to their own home, which hopefully will be a new river centre in their town centre.
Before I monopolise the entire conversation, are there any questions out in the audience? If there is, raise a hand and we'll send a mic over to you. Do not be shy. I will carry on. We've talked about whether we should keep building, how we might fill shopping centres, the role I guess that they, or any kind of retail development, the role they will play, which could be a service and allowing people to pick up goods. What about, can we look a little bit to, I guess, the economic market out there and the funding market to, if we do need to build any more, is there the appetite out there from the funding community to help us build, or do we need to look to new places for cash?
I think it comes down to credibility as to who's lending the money and who's borrowing the money, first and foremost. And I mean, we've recently secured an unsecured debt facility, which will allow us to do our 1.9 million square feet of development, which we've got in the pipeline. And that again comes down to, you know, we're very risk controlled, and what we build we're pre-let. And I think that's, you know, critical to whoever's lending the money, is who's actually borrowing it and what it's going into. So I think it's there to the right borrower.
I think it's a real challenge when you look at where the retail and the F&B market is at the moment. The deals that are being offered on the market, the rents that retailers or F&B operators are prepared to pay. Frankly, looking at a developer from scratch, it doesn't stack up. So how do you make these things happen? The funding market is more risk averse. They're demanding higher pre-let percentages. The reality is most developments probably do at least 50% of their leasing in the last 12 months.
Are there pre-lets out there? I mean, it seemed in Exeter, there just weren't. So.
I think it's very difficult, especially to get somebody, a retailer, be interested in what Mark says, but to get somebody to commit more than, say, 2 or 3 years ahead at the moment. You know, we're getting that feedback from some of the biggest retailers in the UK, in Europe at the moment, in terms of that. So, you know, there is becoming a more speculative nature. So that comes back to who's prepared to take that risk, who's got most to lose, which is why you're seeing a lot of the councils now taking the future into their own hands. They can borrow at a much cheaper rate.
Almost for free.
Yeah, and in 2020 they will get the rates revenue, they'll get council tax revenue from residential, so they can take a much longer term view. Frankly, they might be the only ones that is prepared to take that risk. So it's very, very challenging out there. I think unless, like with New River, where you've got that track record and you've done it before and you've got extremely good relationships, it's very, very difficult to borrow.
Mark, are occupiers willing to commit?
Not many. it's a brave call, isn't it? Going out and signing up to a pre-let, you really need to have done your homework. You need, as I said earlier, a very convincing, very compelling story, and it needs to tick pretty much every box. And I think that the CFOs are becoming increasingly challenging, from what I hear, across all retailers in terms of that longer term commitment, especially for a long income stream. If someone's asking you to sign a 15-year lease and you're not going to start for 3 years, and you've seen how the market's changed over the last 3 years, well, how much of a leap of faith is that? It is a massive leap.
And I'm sure the boxes that retailers want to tick aren't the same boxes that landlords might want ticked.
Well, I think we both want the same thing. I think both retailers and landlords both want long-term sustainable businesses. And those interests can be aligned. And certainly, you know, we've signed 15-year leases with the Primark recently, and they're cautious and know what they're doing. And I think that's what, you know, from our perspective, caution is a good thing, because if a retailer is taking something, they've considered it and they know what they're doing, then that business will be sustainable. And that's exactly what we want. We want that business still there in 15 years, and hence an element of caution is a positive thing.
We're also doing more, targeting more of the better local independents and regional independents, because I think when you look at a number of brands that have come into the UK, especially from Europe, that have come in and failed, honestly, I'd much rather take a local independent operator that's been trading for 10 years plus and has got a track record, who's got a following, than some of the others. Now, clearly, you can't necessarily fill a whole shopping centre with local independents and fund it, so there's always going to be a balance.
And I guess that's where the mix of uses comes in. It's not a shopping centre, isn't all full of retail. It is the F&B, it maybe is the click and collect, it maybe is a office or a co-working unit and things like that.
I think we're getting better at it, but I think you're beginning to now see many more designs come out that are beginning to incorporate those. I think the examples you used at the start were you know, had been there for a while, been trying to get off the ground, and they were an older model that arguably isn't fit for purpose anymore. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think now you're seeing much more about that, because it is about experience, it is about driving footfall through different ways and over a longer period.
John, you look like you have something to say.
I think it's a different approach. We all know the
it's very difficult to get any funding for retail.
Yeah.
Well, both on rents, and therefore no bank would take risks on that. From our perspective, we know that, but because it's our mixed scheme, so we actually lumped it into our the whole development funding pot. As in terms of customer tenants, we are effectively the landlord, so we can actually control and take bids in different market time. But we also explore new tenants, not necessarily those tenants is already established in the UK. We want them, but we're not necessarily all of them. So we have a view of introducing 20-25% of foreign brands. Now, understand that those foreign brands could come and go, but on the other hand, it's far better than have 25% empty space in there.
And the empty space brings us to, I have two more questions before we round up, I suppose. So empty space brings us to America, and there's obviously a big problem out there with the ghost malls, but there's some great videos on YouTube of what they're doing in those. Do you think we're a lot smaller than the States, but do you think there's a fear that we could get to something like that if we don't think about how we develop and fill current planned shopping centres?
I think there is a real fear of that. If you think of how many shopping centres there are in the country and the void rates amongst those shopping centres, I mean, you need a really responsible owner, somebody who'll look after it, curate it in the right way. But you know, some of them need a really radical approach. You know, some of them, frankly, need not just a bit of residential, need knocking down, and maybe they become an urban park in some places. It does need it. There isn't the retail demand out there to fill a lot of those spaces.
I think our occupancy rate's high at 97%, but again, there are other towns and shopping centres that aren't as well occupied, and I think it has to be, as Stuart says, a radical approach to try and find alternative uses for that. And certainly where we've got some bigger space, we're looking at medical centres and gymnasiums are filling a lot of upper floors, and residential is kind of creeping into the New River portfolio, and for those reasons it's filling space. But I don't think, I think the horse has already bolted in places like the States. I don't see, for all the reasons that John's mentioned, shopping centres being funded unless they're pre-let, been built in the middle of nowhere, as they were, certainly seen in Southern Ireland before the recession. And I think everyone's learned a lesson from that. And I don't see such speculative development happening in the foreseeable future.
John?
How we deal with empty space in China, for example. We have a community approach. So when this empty spaces, we normally tend to outside to provide services for community. So invite local governments to provide. They are forward-facing offices, doctor surgery, even a tutorial school, those kind of things. If it's empty space, we want to use those space for community use. And we find that it works because it's bringing the footfall into the area that hopefully eventually the market turnaround can be revert back into a proper retail space. But this is a formula that we have seen it working, and our belief is in the UK it should actually work as well.
Thank you. So one last question, and probably a bit of a mean one to end on, but why not? So at the beginning I talked about there being 7 million square foot of planned retail extensions, give or take a few square feet. How much of that from each of you do you think should be developed? Emma, I'm sorry.
I think if it's been thought through properly and if it's been funded, then for anything to be funded, it has to be probably the bulk of it pre-let. And I think most developers would be approaching any development cautiously. And if there is a need for that, and certainly in a lot of our schemes, we're reconfiguring, and Burgess Hill, for example, we're kind of almost recreating what's existing and turning it into better, bigger space that's fit for purpose. So a lot of it is, of that 7 million square feet, is probably reconfigured space. And again, that's just moving with the times, which is a positive thing. So I think if it's, the 1.9 million that New River have got coming out of the ground will come out of the ground because we know what we're doing.
So at least 1.9 million.
So I'd like to think positively about it, that it will happen.
Stuart?
Yeah, I'd like to try and be positive about it as well. I mean, I think it depends on what your definition of planned is. If it's in for planning and it's been put in for planning in the last year or two, and as Emma said, you'd like to think it's been well thought through and there is a reason for it happening, so you'd like to see the majority. The reality is 75-80%, because, you know, depending on the scale of these developments, it does take a lot longer to go through. You know, we've still got a difficult planning system to go through. They still might be subject to some form of funding as well. So gut feel would be about 75-80%.
That's still pretty positive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
John?
I think it's all down to whether it's business viable. When it's not business viable, then it shouldn't be 7 million square foot and shouldn't even come through planning stage. It's all down to market. 7 million square foot, is it where it is as well, and certain area probably will require more. But I think it's in quite a few areas in the southeast especially, it's quite saturated in terms of retail space.
So it seems if you build it right, get it funded, think about your customer, they will come.
And pre-let it.
And pre-let
it, yeah. Yes.
Guys, thank you ever so much. Emma, Stuart and John and Mark, who had to run and catch a plane. But thank you ever so much for joining us. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry.